Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, this is Ben. This is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Welcome along to episode 57. I'm recording this intro on Tuesday night, having just taken part in a special Small Voice collaboration with Photo Forum, which is a live monthly event here in London, organised by photographers for photographers. Full details at photo-forum.org. And I had the pleasure of doing a live Q&A with my old friend George Giorgio, who presented and talked about his work, including his latest project from the United States, which will at some point be his next book. I think it went okay. It was a great turnout, despite the fact that it's an absolutely foul night here in London. So I just wanted to say thank you to all who attended. Thank you to Travis Hodges for inviting me to do it. And thanks especially to George for taking part. Hopefully there'll be more to come in the future. And this was strictly a live event, so it wasn't recorded. It won't be appearing on the podcast. For those of you who weren't able to be there, you can hear my chat with George on episode 3. Of the podcast, one of the very early ones. My guest this week is Magnum Photo's associate Carolyn Drake. Carolyn studied media and culture and history at Brown University, where she became interested in the ways that history and reality are purposefully shaped and revised over time, and in the ways that artists can interpret and shift these narratives. After graduating, she worked for multimedia companies in New York, but eventually left her office job at the age of 30 to engage with the world through photography. In 2006, she moved to Ukraine, where she spent a year examining cultural partitions in a country pursuing a unified national identity. A cloistered Soviet-era orphanage near the European border, private, state-owned and illegal coal mining groups vying for influence in the Donbass, Crimean Muslims claiming land rights. She made images everywhere, not as much for historical documentation as to come to terms with presumptions stemming from her Cold War childhood in the USA. The experience made her question the journalistic impulse to define and to look for ways photography can emphasise ambiguity. Based in Istanbul between 2007 and 2013, Carolyn travelled frequently to Central Asia to work on two long-term photography projects. The first, Two Rivers, is a poetic exploration of the shifting borders, histories and life systems between the Amu-Darya and Syr-Darya rivers. The interconnectedness of ecology, culture and political power come to view in a territory on the edge of global attention. The second Central Asia project is an amalgam of photographs, drawings and embroideries made in collaboration with Uyghurs in Western China, framed between passages from Nurmu Emet Yassin's contraband story Wild Pigeon. The book puts forth a counter-narrative about China's Western frontier, Islam and the freedoms associated with modernity. In the collaborative images, contrasting visual tools intersect, drawing attention to the awkward, difficult, sometimes beautiful cultural exchange that lies at the root of this series. Carolyn returned to the US in 2014 and is now based in Vallejo, California. She is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Lang Taylor Prize, a Fulbright Fellowship and the Anamorphosis Prize, among other awards. Her work is in the collections of the San Francisco MoMA, Soros Foundation, Library of Congress. Ugh. Oh, look, I can't be bothered to re-record that. You know what I mean, Library of Congress and Ogden Museum of Southern Art. Great photographer. Please enjoy this chat I had with Carolyn Drake. You've got a book, dummy. So what have you been working on?
I have a project that I started. It's one of the smaller projects that I've kind of, I mean, my previous book projects were things that I had worked on over many years, and this one was more made over a shorter period of time, but it's some work from Ukraine that I started right as I was moving out of Istanbul in the process of moving home back to the United States after living abroad for a long time. Before I went home, I wanted to revisit these girls that I had photographed kind of at the beginning of my career as like a foreign photographer and abroad.
Was in Ukraine.
I had photographed these girls in Ukraine in like 2006. And before I moved back home, I wanted to revisit them and So that's what this project is revisiting these girls who I had been out of touch with for 8 years and coming back with a kind of different perspective on photography. And just to try and reconnect with them.
And so they were how old when you first saw them? Roughly?
Around 12.
Okay, so it's a sort of transition to young adulthood, really.
Yeah, and they're adults now. Right. And I thought I would come back and find them. I would have to spend a lot of time tracking them down individually, but it turned out they were still living the same kind of boarding house that I had found them when I first met them.
So their lives hadn't really changed a great deal. I mean, clearly in terms of getting older, but not in terms of their circumstances.
Yeah, that was one thing I thought a lot about, because for one thing, the work that I had just done before in China was a lot about this fast changing landscape and cultural environment. And these girls, when I came back to them, the revolution had just happened in Kiev. So there was this expectation of the whole country would be changing and ready for reforming and maybe moving towards Europe. But with these girls, yeah, it was more of a situation of very little change. I mean, the change that had happened in those 8 years was they had become adults, and that's very dramatic, obviously, but not much else had changed. They were the same building, the same huge concrete wall around it, isolating them from other people.
Mm. So that's sort of interesting, because against the backdrop of kind of quite significant change in the wider picture, you sort of focused on them.
Well, there were also questions about how much change was actually taking place in the wider picture. And the question of whether these girls and their lives, which were very contained in this walled environment, were a reflection of what was happening outside or not.
Yeah, it was a way to explore that in a way, but I suppose in a slightly kind of indirect way. So is that internet? There's a thing on your website called internet. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And you've made a little book dummy that you're sort of showing to people, because you've done two extremely well-received books so far. We're going to talk about those projects, obviously. But I was wondering about what it's like to be back in the States after so long of living abroad.
It's been a strange, challenging transition. My partner and I both went back to the United States because we wanted to make work there, and we felt really disconnected from this place that we had kind of come from, and thought we just had this pull to try and work there as a photographer. After maybe we felt we had a distance, maybe that would allow us to kind of approach visually with a distance or with a perspective that we wouldn't have had having lived there for all those years. But it was hard to find. I mean, it's such a huge country. We had been away for so long that we didn't really know where to go back to. So we spent a few years moving around the country, trying to figure out what to work on. And Andres figured it out a little more quickly than I did. But
he's a photographer as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, okay, so you sort of kind of working on the same or in the same area together, as it were.
We first moved
to some agreement, not just like a normal couple, but also as photographers, as it were.
Yeah, there's definitely a dialogue. I mean, it's nice to share with somebody else, you know, the discussion about where to go, why.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's always driven by our work, so. Like, yeah. Where we're going to move is really about what work we want to make.
Did you find coming back to work, you know, you were sort of approaching your own country with a fresh eye in a way.
I mean, I remember when I would go back to the United States to visit while I was living in Istanbul, looking around like, this, like, I don't understand this place. And especially when we would go to California, and it was just this sense of perfection on the coast, like on the West Coast, and feeling very estranged from, like, that, I couldn't connect with that. And so I liked the idea of trying to engage with that photographically, because for me, making photo work is kind of about trying to connect. So I guess starting from a place of strangeness, that obviously changes when I start making work. So,
'cause like you weren't from, neither of you are from California originally. Or was that part of America that you were familiar
actually,
with?
Actually, he grew up in the Bay Area, and okay. I was born in Los Angeles, but I moved away when I was a little kid.
Okay. So he was familiar with that area, that place. I'm just wondering how you sort of, you know, work together and how you kind of react to each other's work in a way. You know, you sort of do you find you're sort of subconsciously influenced in a way by what the other person's doing? Or, you know, maybe there's some kind of weird, you know, cross-pollination.
I would say there's definitely a cross-pollination. I mean, we get feedback from each other, and we tear down each other's ideas, or we accept each other's ideas, and I'm sure that influences each other's decisions. Mm. But we also, I think, very consciously want to keep our identities distinct. I mean, we've talked about collaborating before and have never gotten around to that, because it's just, I think it's very important to both of us to kind of have an independence in terms of our artwork.
Mm.
But I think we're each other's main bouncing board.
Yeah, you've got a sort of in-house, you know, kind of, yeah, very much like Vanessa Winship and George Giorgio, who we both know, and they, you know, have worked together for many years, but yeah, they have their own way of doing it, which is to sort of work, kind of support each other, but yeah, kind of take turns in a way. But yeah, it's nice to have that, and have someone who understands and who can, you know, add something. So let's sort of start at the beginning, really. How did you first get drawn to photography?
Let's see. Well, there were a couple of times when I like had a darkroom class. It's like when I was a junior high school student, there was this math teacher who was a real unusual character, almost kind of a geek, but he had a lot of charisma, and he installed a dark room in the basement of the science lab, and got some of us to get into like black and white photography. But that kind of came and went, and then I took another photo class in college. So I always found it a fun process, but I never conceived it as something that could be like your life.
Right.
I just thought that was like something you could do as a hobby for fun. Right. But so it wasn't till much later, I graduated from college and I had gone to New York to work. I was working like in kind of doing interactive design and concept development for multimedia publications, and I think after several years of that, I really needed to get out of that office environment, out of this kind of Silicon Alley bubble that I was living in, and film I think my first entry into the idea of documentary was through film and when I was in college, and so but I took a couple classes at ICP, I guess, while I was working in New York.
I mean, did it seem to you like a sort of passport to, you know, get out of that very almost kind of claustrophobic world and then and have an excuse to sort of get out into the world and see, you know?
Yeah, it was a way of engaging, like, with the physical world and of intersecting with people outside of my little bubble and just becoming more aware of, like, real life beyond the one that I had been experiencing in New York.
So at what point did it become a serious thing then? I mean, what point did you realize that it was something you could really, you know, make a career out of?
I think one thing that happened is I took a sabbatical from my job and I went on this trip around the world, and it was just a few months, but when I came back, I realized I could make any choice in the world. Like, there was so many possibilities for, I guess it just gave me confidence that I don't have to stay on that same path forever. Just right. Step outside of it and there you are. So at that point, I think I was also taking these classes at ICP, and I was like, I want to try and take this more seriously. And I went to grad school, I guess. I enrolled in like a full-time program in Ohio, and that was like an excuse to really start being serious about it. And like, just this mental switch that happened, like, okay, now this is serious.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, the region that you've sort of ended up really, you know, dedicating yourself to, Central Asia, or Xinjiang, you know, in particular, Western China. How did you end up there? What drew you to that region as a photographer?
Well, I had actually spent a year in Ukraine.
Okay, so, yeah, it came out of that?
It came out of this kind of exploration of the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, and Ukraine being the kind of launching pad for, you know, that's the West. So I wanted to kind of travel beyond to the opposite side of what was the Soviet Union. And that's, and then from there, I was right on the edge of China. And I was just on a backpacking trip with my friend Andrew, and we just decided to cross into China, and that's how the Xinjiang project began.
Right, okay.
It was
did you know anything about?
Never premeditated, like, oh, I know I'm gonna, because, you know, for my whole life I've been studying this subject, or I have these family roots from this region, and so I have to go there. And it was more kind of never predetermined.
Yeah. But something about that, I mean, was it, what was it about it? Was it the sort of political kind of context, or, you know, something about the people themselves, or, you know, what do you think drew you to that?
What I think interested me, I guess, from an intellectual, more like analytical point of view, is that it was kind of on the border of these known cultures like Russia, China, Afghanistan, Iran, like these things we know or we think we know already. And Central Asia was this place where those things were all intertwined somehow. It was on the border of all those places, and it didn't quite fit into any one of those niches. And to me, that was, it made it an appealing place to try and make images, because I felt like it had all of those stereotypes and none of them at the same, they were all blended together, and it gave me a sense of I guess freshness that I felt was worth returning to.
Yeah. Well, in the end, it was 15 trips or something. So clearly, you've obviously got a lot of commitment once you start something. Are you that way inclined? Are you sort of quite? Yeah.
Well, yeah. I have tended so far to kind of embark on these very long-winded projects. And it wasn't, you know, this Ukraine project that I'm putting together now, I think I intentionally wanted to find something a lot narrower. Like, the Central Asia work was, the Two Rivers project was in 5 countries, returning over and over over many years, and the Xinjiang project was also covering a very wide geographic area and a lot of time spent there, and I think I wanted to try next to do something that was kind of standing still rather than about traveling and not necessarily about geography. But yeah, I think I like, with each new phase, to find something new, maybe to try and not repeat
yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote down use of color, discuss. That's all I got. What could we, what do you have to say to that? Or, you know, do you have any sort of particular thoughts on that?
I guess I would just say, I have realized when I edit my work, a lot of times color comes into it, and I'm more conscious of it now. Like, I don't think I ever realized I was looking at color, but now when I'm looking through the camera, I'm more conscious of whether it's there, and more conscious that that's part of my work.
Okay, but for so initially you weren't so conscious of it. It's become something that you become more aware of just by doing it. But it wasn't a sort of something that you made any kind of active decision to consider carefully.
Right. It was a organic development.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Fair enough. No, because I think that. Yeah, that's interesting, I think, because, my friend Ian Tay has, you know, said to me that he started working in black and white, but when he changed the colour, he made a very kind of conscious decision about it. And I think it's interesting that, you know, that isn't always the case necessarily. And these things reveal themselves, like you've already kind of mentioned, in the editing in a way initially, and you start to see these things once you've got the pictures in front of you.
Yeah, and there's some pictures that I'm looking at, I'm just wishing they would work, and I'm wondering what's wrong with them. And what I realize eventually is that the color, it's just, there's no color. And somehow that's, I mean, when I went back to the U.S. for a brief moment, I tried looking at this new work in black and white, and toyed with the idea of switching, but
oh really?
It didn't. I'm sticking.
So you actually
color.
Looked at it. You actually.
I looked at it in black and white.
Yeah, but I think it's fun to do that. It's always interesting to just at least see what that looks like, even if you don't ultimately do anything about it.
Yeah, and I like the idea of allowing a mixture, mixing the two. I like that idea.
So you might ultimately do something.
I don't know.
You like the idea, but not that much.
We'll see.
Well, so the project, it was about 6 years in the making. Was it Two Rivers was the first book, wasn't it? That's the one that came out of this body of work that we've been talking about, which you self funded on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Very successfully. I think you massively overshot your target. What did you learn from that process about doing that? Because it's something that a lot of people are now doing or thinking of doing.
Well, I found the whole process of actually putting together the presentation for Kickstarter to be kind of a useful process to go through, because it forced me to explain myself in words, like spoken words, and to make what I said reflect the images. And so in that sense, it was a good exercise.
Because you were able to sort of crystallize in your own head.
And it helped me fund the book. I think it was a great way of, you know, promoting my first book, making it accessible, helping people find out about it. And I also feel a little bit like it's something you should only do once. So, you know, now I'm in a situation again where I need money for a book, but I don't know if I want to go there again.
Oh, really? You might try something different. Yeah. In terms of the book, I mean, the design and the layout and all that, the book itself, that seems to have become, I don't know how you feel about, clearly that's an important element to it, because you've really thought about that very carefully with both those projects, it seems to me. I mean, the way that the book is physically, you know, has been much kind of commented on, I suppose. Tell me a little bit about, you know, how you came to that process, and, you know, whether it was always something that you knew was going to be important to you.
Well, it took me a long time to figure out how to put a book together with the two rivers. I spent a couple of years trying to figure out, you know, first I went to the Kassel Photo Book Festival, and I started looking at a lot of other books and looking at designers, book designers, and how, what kind of role they would play in bookmaking, and asking about, like, just learning about the whole process of how a publisher works. And it was just, you know, very, I knew nothing about that. I hadn't ever made a book before, like in school, it's not something that came up. And what I realized, I had a lot of ideas in the work that I realized that could be pushed more if with design, and that I decided I wanted to work with a designer who would help me push those ideas, instead of trying to make like a monograph of here are my amazing pictures from Central Asia.
So you're trying to bring something more to it than that.
Yeah. And so it became more, I decided it was more important to make a book that was carried ideas than it was to make a book that celebrated my photos.
Mm. Well, you also included quite a lot of text.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was, well, you collaborated with a writer. Tell me about that, because you could have just, I guess, used your own, you know, you could have just done it yourself, but you didn't. You brought someone in to work with.
Yeah. So that book was really a collaboration on many fronts, with the design and then with Elif Batuman, the writer. And the way that evolved, we had started designing the book, and I thought, okay, should these images have captions? What am I going to do with the text? And I decided it needed, because the images were from such a kind of unknown location, I felt there needed to be some explanation. And so I started trying to write these. We had the design, the way that kind of the images would flow in this cinematic way over the folds of the pages and kind of like a river. Mm-hmm. And So I tried writing these little vignettes for each of the chapters that would, where there would be a caption for each image, but it was so that it would be written like a flowing poem or paragraph, so that each caption would connect to the next, just kind of like the images were laid out in the book. And I wrote these things that were like, almost like a long poem, but they were captions. And it was cool, I liked it, but it just, I felt I wanted a better writer.
Yeah.
I wanted, so.
Well, this is about sort of recognizing your strengths and weaknesses in a way, isn't it? I think that's probably a good lesson in there, you know, that you've got to, you know, you've got to recognize your limits, I suppose. Not that I don't, you know, I'm sure you could have done, but the fact that
you. Yeah, I mean, Elif also, she had written this book, her first book had taken place between Uzbekistan and Russia, and I was very excited to read that book, and I was really just blown away by her, the way she thought about place and gave it meaning. And so she seemed like the ideal person to have, like, I was really lucky that when I approached her with it, she agreed. And so she turned it into this text where she basically interviewed me about the pictures and then wrote her own story about the stories that I had told her. And it kind of made, it gave, it changed the, I guess, the words from captions into something that is a little more complex.
So you did bring in a new dimension to it, you know, just by allowing that collaboration to just, you know, take it in its own direction.
And I think it gave, I like that it gave the images the chance to be imaginary. Like, we didn't have to define this is what the image means, this is what it's of, or this is what the actual thing that it's about, but it allowed them the chance to be interpreted through many voices.
I think that's it. And so you do you sort of seek out that kind of ambiguity in your images, that sense of, you know, they're not really being any definitive answer of what it's about. You're kind of, it's almost, you know, you're more asking a question than giving an answer.
That's a good way of putting
it. So then, and that book did very well. You sold all of them. It was incredibly well received, I think, but by, you know, all and sundry. So the second project was Wild Pigeon, which was more of your, what was your Uyghur work, really, your project about Xinjiang. And with that, you did something else quite interesting, which was that you allowed, you know, some of the subjects to, you know, kind of scribble on the pictures, essentially. How did that idea come about?
I had looked a lot at the work of Wendy Ewald. I had this book that was like a compilation of all of these projects she did around the world. And so I had read about her approach to collaborating and found it very inspiring. 'Cause I think I was dealing with this, especially with this work in Xinjiang, more and more feeling the problem of basically that I had been going into this very foreign environment and, you know, like trying to use photography to tell these people's story, and feeling like that wasn't quite, I needed, it just didn't feel right. Like, I really felt like I needed to kind of let go of some of the authorship, and I wanted to bring these people into the work, the people that I was photographing, and have it be partly from them. And I think I had looked at the work of Jim Goldberg too. And so I started by just bringing prints and colored pencils and asking people to draw on them, but I later came back. I was in this book lab, I participated in this book lab in Istanbul, and I met a Turkish photographer who told me about this work where he had taken all of these kind of protest pictures he had shot in Turkey and publicly put them on like fences or walls on the streets and then layered them on top of each other, and people had started on the street had torn pieces of them off. And so it becomes this work of art that's made by the people on the street as little pieces of the pictures are torn away and the layers are revealed. So the second part of the work where people were making collages kind of came from hearing about his work. And it made a lot of sense for me, I thought, in Xinjiang, because this what I had been seeing there, the landscape of the Uyghur people being torn down and replaced with something dramatically different, but not by them, like by China, the Chinese government, basically. And so it seemed to make sense to maybe we could mimic that process by tearing up my pictures, but then they would put them back together in a way that they felt was expressing their view.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's a very complex situation, and maybe you could give us some sort of kind of summary of what the score is. What's happening in Xinjiang, and how's that been developing over the time that you've been interested in that area?
Well, I haven't been back there since 2013, and I guess a lot has probably changed since then. But what was going on was there are these people, Uyghurs, who have lived in this province that's like, it's called Xinjiang, but that's the Chinese name for it. It's this giant province that's basically a giant desert, but on the edges of the desert, there's oases, and the Uyghurs have been farming and trading there for a long, long time. And China has been over the past, this has been going on since the Cultural Revolution, but more and more in the last couple decades, the government's been investing in sending Han Chinese people who are kind of loyal to the government into this region, populating, kind of diluting the minority, diluting the Muslim population there intentionally, and developing it to exploit a lot of the natural resources there. And because there are several Muslim countries that are independent that are on the border of Xinjiang, there's also this concern that there's an independence movement among the Uyghurs, and that by bringing in, kind of asserting more control over this region, China can prevent the Uyghurs from separating.
Right, yeah.
So they've been also imposing a lot of really rigid restrictions on Uyghurs' ability to practice their religion and their language and have economic independence. And it's, I think, really there, and there's no kind of ability for or option for people to protest those changes.
Right. Yeah. What are some of the challenges of shooting in that region? I mean, I think there are sort of religious taboos or cultural taboos about even getting photographed among some of the population. But what are some of the main challenges that you came across?
Well, the people there are very open for the most part. I mean, they're not, their form of Islam has been its own entity. And most of the people I met were very open to photography. And there's a really kind of active street life there, so it's a really fun place to like be on the street with a camera.
Right.
The challenges were mostly because you're not supposed to, because of the rules set by the government, where especially after 2009 when there were riots in the capital in Urumqi, there are a lot more regulations about where foreigners could go, who they could talk to, and what they could do with the camera. And you weren't supposed to go there unless you're, as a photographer, unless you're accompanied by a, like an official guide.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So those, at some point, it became kind of trying to sneak around, and that was the main challenge, avoiding just kind of laying low and passing as a tourist.
Yeah, yeah. How are you in your own company? I mean, that's a lot of, years and years of constant trips, and, you know, there's a lot of solitude involved, and, you know, how do you sort of manage all those issues when you're out shooting, you know, other parts of the world? Is that something you've had to sort of figure out how to deal with over the years?
Yeah, I think, I guess I'm maybe a little bit of a loner, so it was maybe suitable for me in some way.
Yeah, that's handy if you're going to do what you do, right?
And I have tended to, when I'm working on projects in foreign places and I have a translator, I tend to get close with those people, become good friends with them, and so those are the people who
So you form friendships with people,
yeah.
With the people that you're photographing half the time, yeah. So that book, you funded that from the Anamorphosis. Is it Anamorphosis? That's sort of not an easy word to say.
The prize.
You won a prize, but was that after the fact?
Yeah, that was after I published it.
Okay, fine. So how did you fund it initially then?
The Wild Pigeon book, I funded with my own money.
Okay, so you didn't have to do the Kickstarter thing, you just...
Mm-hmm. I had saved money.
Yeah, yeah, okay, cool.
The next book right now, I don't have money left,
right. So this is why you're sort of wondering whether to return to the Kickstarter thing, yeah, or not. It seems to be increasingly, you know, a popular way of doing it. So somewhere along the lines, you got into Magnum Photos, a little-known photo agency. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. Did that seem like a big deal to you at the time?
It was a big deal because I knew that if you join that agency, it's you have to commit to that agency, and it was more of a commitment than with the previous agency that I had been working with, where I was kind of, I was mostly doing my own thing.
Hmm. Was Magnum a goal? Or was it unexpected that it worked out that way?
It was not in my plans. I think it happened because a few people approached me about it, and I was in the process of moving back to the States and thought it just might be good timing if I, and...
So you'd already done, you'd done both books?
Yeah, I had finished both books.
So you had a huge body of work and two very successful books already in the can, as it were. And then
I think I've found just in general in my career that working on my own and not worrying about achieving a certain thing is the best approach to take.
And well, it seems to have worked for you because you've achieved really quite a lot, Carolyn. I would have to say the career seems to be going well from the outside anyway. I'm sure you probably tell me all the reasons why it isn't really. But no, it's going great. But so what, someone from Magnum kind of approach, this is this kind of semi-secret process, which isn't really secret, but someone sort of suggests that it might be a good idea for you to apply. Who was your sponsor, as it were? Who was in your corner?
Well, I first met Martin Parr at Paris Photo when my Wild Pigeon book came out, and I sat down and talked to him a bit.
Yeah, he was a fan, right, of the books?
Yeah. He liked the book, which made me very happy. I talked to him, and then Jim Goldberg, I sent him my book, and he said, have you thought of applying to Magnum? And then I got a call from Chris Anderson, and he said he and some of his friends thought I should apply. And so I felt like, well, it seems like there's several people who might support me. So I thought I would not want to apply to Magnum unless I was pretty sure
that you're going to get in.
Yeah.
What, you wouldn't be able to face the rejection if you...
It would just be...
It's like, why did I bother kind of thing, do you think?
I don't know. I just felt like, okay, if these people think I would make a nice addition to the agency, I'll give it a try.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it worked. And when did you get the news that you were in? How do you remember that moment?
Oh, it was a big relief.
Yeah. What was it, a phone call?
I think I don't remember exactly. People emailed me, maybe.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a big achievement. But then there's the pressure of having to sort of deliver, I suppose, because there's this process whereby you're not fully in, kind of thing. You're on probation, essentially. Where are you now? You're a full member now?
No, and so I think in about a month I have to submit a new portfolio.
Mm. Are you in that middle phase, or are you still you're an associate?
Oh, I will, if they accept me, then I will be an associate.
Okay. All right, okay, right, yeah. And now we just need to get this, we need to figure this
I'm
out.
I'm not a huge fan of the whole
judging
process, actually.
But I mean, isn't it their way of simply maintaining a standard, and you know, in a way it's kind of, you know, it does make it a bit special that you have to jump through these hoops, you know, and that's their way of saying this is fucking sick, you know, this is Magnum kind of thing, don't you think? Or would you rather,
yeah,
you'd rather it's just like, come on, you're in, it's fine.
Let me think.
Well, you have to be
diplomatic. I mean, I understand, you know, the idea that you have to really, like, prove the need to prove yourself. But I think there's a certain, how can I explain? I guess I'm just, in general, the idea of other people judging you as a photographer or as an artist is not quite the right way to approach artwork, because I don't believe there is any one way, you know, if you have to choose 10 people, oh, this one person is the best and this one is the worst. They all have something to offer and a different approach and a different body of work, and I don't like the idea of ranking, I guess. Mm. So anytime I come across a contest where there's a jury making the decision about which one is the best, I'm a little skeptical.
Right. Yeah. Good point. Well, yeah, juries and competitions have been very much, you know, kind of in the news, because there's been quite a lot of controversy lately. Do you keep abreast of that kind of those kind of issues? There's been quite a lot of ethical questions being asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen a lot of it on the social media. This mostly, I guess, within photojournalism, where I guess there's the idea that there has to be certain rules that you follow.
Yeah, a kind of ethical guidelines. Yeah, I would say so. Well, especially in a business which, you know, is kind of dependent on, you know, the notion of trustworthiness and honesty. And if those things are called into question by photographers who are, you know, transcending those ethical boundaries, then the whole thing gets called into question. You know, it's...
Well, okay. I think that's an example of how there's this pressure to please somebody. I don't know who it, like the prize judges or the photo, whoever's in charge of the photo world.
Yeah.
This idea of doing whatever you can to please them, and that diverts the photographer or the artist from following maybe a more honest path.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I think that's the point that's being made, you know, extensively, which is that, you know, whilst one can point the finger at the individual photographer, and clearly, you know, one knows the difference between right and wrong. You know, if you put a caption on a picture which is simply not true, then you've stepped outside a very obvious boundary. But at the same time, like you say, the root cause of that kind of behavior is perhaps the pressure to win awards or whatever. I mean, I don't know, I'm just sort of putting it out there because, you know, it's quite a complex issue in some ways. But, you know, is it for you, it's more, is it as much about, it's not kind of so much about you, but it's about the subject that you're photographing. I mean, like, as you've already said that, you know, you allowed a certain amount of collaboration with your subjects in Wild Pigeon. And I know that's something that a lot of other photographers, you know, from that kind of tradition do. But yeah, for some people, it kind of maybe it becomes a bit of an ego trip, really, and they forget that it's really about, you know, bringing certain, I guess, certain struggles to light or whatever. Is that something you think about?
Yeah, I guess I'm torn about this whole idea of bringing certain struggles to light, because it is something that I do, but I don't think my whole mission is to like bring struggles to light. I'm more interested in, and maybe this is something that I haven't gotten to this place in making work yet, where I want to make work that is real about the pain in the world, maybe not just pretty but intense and I guess emotional, but it doesn't have to necessarily bring the struggles to light. It's more important for me that it's a reflection of some kind of state of mind, or a reflection on how I'm seeing and interpreting a place. And
it's a bit more of a lyrical kind of approach rather than a straightforward kind of more, you know, like you say, photojournalistic, this is what the story is kind of approach. You're in that kind of area, which I think is increasingly interesting, where maybe documentary meets something else or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. You start bloody using these ridiculous, you know, pigeonholes,
words,
which are problematic in themselves. But I think you probably take my point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your work is, well, how do you place it in a way? If that's a, sorry, I was just about to break off and say, if that's a ridiculous question, you don't really have to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think maybe there's a need to have these categories of like how to define certain kinds of photography or certain kinds of work, but I don't enjoy having to like categorize myself.
No, I don't think anyone does.
So.
What have you kind of learnt about yourself by being a photographer, do you think?
I mean, I am a very insecure, inquisitive person. I tend to, and I think maybe one of the things that is a challenge about myself, but is ends up being a strength in my work is, I see a lot of layers in the world and I try and pull them out and I investigate them, and it's all a big, the way it happens in my brain is very scattered and and I try and let that come into my image making process, like not having a preset plan, exploring all the aspects that come into my head, that all the ideas that I have, trying not to let them, trying to be open to all of them. And but that's a reflection of a very like kind of scattered brain. But I, in the end, I...
Well, a creative brain, I suppose, is quite often that way.
Yeah, and...
A creative person's brain, I mean, you know.
Yeah, and I guess it's a kind of finding a way to let that out and then pull it together in a way that has some cohesion.
But I wouldn't have had you as an insecure person at all. Because you've got, you obviously, as I say, you've obviously, you're very committed and you've got a sort of, I don't know, you must, there must be a real sort of steely strength behind that, all that.
I guess I have a lot of self-motivation. I kind of trust myself more. I won't.
Where does that come from? Is that from your parents, do you think? Or is it, you know, kind of innate?
Somehow I think I grew up in a way that was a little outside normal. I mean, I was never really in the middle of things. I was a little bit of an outsider everywhere I went, and my family was a little weird. Like, we wouldn't go on, when we would go on a vacation, we would go camping. And everyone else would go to a hotel, and it was just, I always felt, and then my mother was a Christian Scientist, and I had, and my dad was a scientist, so there was this kind of conflict within the home very...
Yeah, he was a person of science, presumably not religious.
Correct.
And your mom was evidently quite religious, so yeah, there was an interesting dynamic there.
Yeah, and these two very seemingly opposing perspectives on life and the meaning of life.
Yeah, how did they
in one household?
And did they manage to negotiate that dynamic, you know, between the two of them?
Well, it's still ongoing.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a very good sign then. I mean, it's obviously they're making that work. And yeah, so that must have been weird. But did you have brothers and sisters?
I have a sister.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And you felt a bit of an outsider, maybe? Were you very sort of self-contained, or were you shy, or?
I was very shy, and I did sports when I was a kid, like, so I was really focused on things. I focused on my gymnastics, and then I quit that, and I focused on swimming.
Okay, so maybe that's where you learned that.
Yeah,
to do that,
not giving up.
Yeah, incredibly important. Probably the most important thing anyone can learn.
And there's a lot of incentives to give up because of the money and because initially, I think when you start a new body of work, it's not easy to get it, you know, and you have to keep building it in order to get it to a point where people can respond to it, other people. And and there's a lot of errors that I make along the way all the time, and kind of working through those errors and solving the problems. And
That's a great point, I think, because it's just, yeah, I just, yeah, I, sometimes life just feels like you're lurching from one mistake to another. So if you've got any tips on how to, you know, kind of negotiate that issue, that would be good.
Well, one thing I kind of work on is this, I would like to be able to work against perfection. I could just, that's pretty much sums up.
How do you mean, though? What do you mean? You mean resist the tendency to be a perfectionist? Or am I just misinterpreting what you mean?
I guess I'm thinking that, and this comes from the collaborating that I've been doing, and this belief that maybe what is more beautiful is like this kind of awkward zone that's like between what I'm making and what other people make, and the where we intersect is a kind of beautiful place. And it's not a perfect looking thing, but it's kind of genuine.
Yeah, authentic.
Yeah. And I guess I'm trying towards, you know, there's nothing genuine, really. There's no real genuine or no real authenticity, but trying to achieve something that feels like that, I think, is more what I'm interested in than making something perfect looking.
Mm. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, it's impossible. I mean, you could drive yourself nuts trying to do that. Well, who were you influenced by then? Who are the photographers whose work you're sort of, you know, trying to not emulate, but, you know, who you just, people that you just, you know,
wanna... I think it's changed over time. I mean, it kind of depends what I'm working on, but like, right, I've been interested in Boris Mikhailov, Anu Kroitov and her ways of experimenting and playing, but in a intellectual way. Stephen Gill is someone whose work I really love. So those are like three people that I'm really interested in at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. What are your hopes for this book? I mean, obviously you want to get it out into the world, but given that you've already done two very successfully, does that not make the process a little easier in attracting, you know, some of the bigger publishers, or are you more you know, set on the idea of somehow doing it yourself?
I'm debating about it.
Yeah, because I mean, from everything that I've come to understand, you know, if you go with a big publisher, and we're sort of, I know we're kind of jumping around here from the most kind of abstract discussions to the most, you know, in some ways mundane sort of pragmatic things. But yeah, you can have the kudos of going with a big publisher, but actually you end up with very little money. Mm-hmm. And doing it yourself is, you know, there's a lot more kind of risk involved and everything, but at least it seems to be financially a more sensible way to do it. And you know, you're obviously experienced now at that.
I think, I don't know if there's any more risk in self-publishing than there is in using a publisher, like, because it seems a lot of publishers want you to pay for it anyway.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little torn about self-publishing versus publishing. Mm. I think.
But you want to show it to some people anyway, and maybe get some.
Yeah, I think
feedback.
I'm just gonna show it around and see how things evolve. And
yeah,
but natural path seems to just do it the way I did before, because. Yeah. That's the way I've done it, but I never like to.
I'm just wondering where do Magnum fit into all this? Because isn't it up? Isn't it there? I mean, what are they just going to, you know, sit around and just expect you to go? Aren't they supposed to be doing this for you? This kind of stuff, isn't that what an agency is kind of partly for? Without getting into any controversy,
have you interviewed a lot of people involved with Magnum?
I've interviewed a few. Yeah, why?
Do they answer all of your questions?
Some of them do. Some of them definitely err on the side of diplomacy. And I the reason I talk to a lot of Magnum people is not because I have got some kind of fetish for Magnum, but because I love documentary photography, and that's where my heart is, and that's essentially, broadly speaking, where, you know, this podcast, you know, is kind of focused. It's just nice to, you know, obviously a lot of your peers at Magnum are people I'm just interested in talking to. But yeah, no, I don't know. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they avoid them. as you have done now, Carolyn, very cleverly.
Well, I mean, I don't know. What I've heard from people in Magnum is that the best way to, because I'm new into Magnum,
and they
told me that you should use it how you want to use it, and it's up to you to decide how much you want to get involved and what you want to get involved with. And they obviously have a kind of history and continuing involvement in the editorial world, in magazine assignments.
Right.
And I think they're good in that arena. And from what I have gathered, like when you publish your book, most people kind of do that on their own. And I think everyone has a... And then if you want Magnum to help you promote the book or help you sell it, they can do that.
Yeah, but I mean, that's where they can be very, very useful, I suppose, because they do have a massive presence. And, you know, they're a famous brand and they can bring a certain amount of weight to that just because of the fact they've got an enormous social media following. But yeah, no, I mean, it just, like you say, I think it seems to be that you're kind of on your own and you're not on your own. And there's a looseness to it.
I think it's really important for people to be able to exist outside of Magnum and have their own artistic presence independently. And want to lose that, and that's what I have there to Magnum.
That's exactly the kind of person that Magnum wants in a way. So there's that, you know, kind of weird dynamic in a way that they're actively looking for people who kind of don't want to be. It's almost like I would never be a member of a club that would have me as a member. You know, I wouldn't join a club that has like Groucho Marx, right? I mean, it's kind of like that.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. Well, Carolyn, thank you for talking. I really appreciate you making the time. Thanks so much. It was great to meet you. And good luck with your future endeavors. This other book, I'm sure we will see eventually when it comes to life. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you a lot.